Hi, and welcome to It's Complicated, a podcast about healthcare ethics and practice presented by the Nova Scotia Health Ethics Network, or NCHEN. I'm Amanda Porter, a member of the operations team here at NCHEN, and I'll be your host for this discussion. Today's podcast is the third in a series that explores harm reduction. Today, we'll be looking more closely at harm reduction and addiction medicine in an inpatient setting. I'm very pleased to introduce our guest for today's discussion, Dr. Tommy Brothers.
Hi, Amanda. Good morning.
Dr. Tommy Brothers, he/him, is an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at Dalhousie University and a staff physician in addiction medicine and in general internal medicine at the QE2 Health Sciences Center in Halifax. Dr. Brothers helped to organize and implement the first hospital-based addiction medicine consult service in Atlantic Canada here in Halifax. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Brothers. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Thanks very much for having me.
So can you tell me a little bit about how you got into addiction medicine?
Certainly. I did medical school and residency training here in Halifax. And early in my training in medical school, we actually had very little exposure to addiction medicine. But I got to do some community elective rotations with Mobile Outreach Street Health, MOSH, the primary care street nursing service in our community, and with Mainline Needle Exchange, who do outreach supporting people who use drugs and providing harm reduction equipment and connecting people with social services. And so early in med school, I got to see that model of care where it was harm reduction focused, but it was just building relationships and supporting people and helping them with what they needed. And often that could involve addiction treatment and medications, but most of the time it didn't. And I thought that was really inspiring and the kind of care I wanted to provide as a doctor in training. And then when I started my hospital rotations, I loved the medicine, but it was clear that something was horribly wrong. We didn't have any services for people who use drugs. We didn't have anybody working in the hospital who could provide support, start medications, treat withdrawal. There was so much discomfort, a lack of awareness and education. And even in those training rotations, I would be forcing patients into withdrawal and not treating their pain because they had an addiction. And I thought I wasn't supposed to do that. And it'd be often some of the same people that I met on these outreach electives, you know, trying to provide care and build trust in the community, came into hospital and were suffering horribly. So I started phoning some of these community organizations and the physicians that they work with and asking, what should we do? Because nobody in the hospital seemed to know what to do. And it turns out there was lots we could do. There was lots of evidence-based interventions that we weren't offering. There was a whole different approach we should take, which was addiction medicine and harm reduction. So with their supervision from afar, I started trying out some of these things and could see the impact immediately and sought out extra training and accidentally became a local resource in the hospital to colleagues. And that was kind of how I got started.
That's really interesting. Thanks for sharing that. So today we're going to do something a little different. We're going to do a case study, and then we're going to follow up with a few discussion questions about it. So I'm going to go ahead and read this case study. So Jenny is a 36-year-old cis woman admitted to hospital for injection drug use associated infective endocarditis. Standard treatment involves 2 to 6 weeks of IV antibiotics, investigations like heart ultrasounds, and can involve open heart surgery. Jenny has untreated opioid use disorder, and her sterile drug use equipment was confiscated at admission. On the unit, Jenny is in pain and is irritable, but has received no regularly scheduled pain medication. She is upset, swearing frequently when she is engaged by bedside nursing staff. When the inpatient care team denied her request for pain medication, she flipped her lunch tray towards a nurse, saying that she would need to leave hospital. Jenny is visited by her friends, who staff suspect of supplying Jenny with illicit drugs. She leaves the unit to smoke, sometimes missing visits from consulting professionals. Jenny is visited by the Addiction Medicine Consult Service, who agree with Jenny that she is in opioid withdrawal and prescribe her opioid medications to treat her withdrawal and pain, and to enable her to stay on in the unit for the duration of her investigations and treatment. Jenny explains to the team that she is terrified of her life-threatening infection, feels emotionally distressed because the restrictive hospital environment reminds her of traumatic experiences while incarcerated, and was upset that no one was taking her seriously. Jenny expresses interest in starting evidence-based treatment for opioid use disorder with methadone before discharge. Some nursing team members express discomfort with providing Jenny with prescribed opioids, explaining that they feel it is unsafe to give her opioids when they suspect her of using non-prescribed substances as well. Some say that providing opioids makes them feel like a drug dealer. So I'm interested, Dr. Brothers, in what it can be like to be a patient like Jenny in acute care who has a substance use disorder.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I appreciate in the case here, Jenny has shared much of that with us already. Our acute care hospitals were not designed originally. Most of our acute care hospitals still not are designed to meet the needs of people with substance use disorders, and especially people who use criminalized drugs, injection drugs, and experience other kinds of marginalization, including poverty and homelessness. We designed them, you know, to treat organ-specific diseases and have an included harm reduction and addiction medicine as part of that system of care. So routinely, people don't have opioid withdrawal identified, aren't offered medications to relieve it, are restricted or denied pain medication. I think that, you know, many healthcare providers mean well. That's why we get into this profession. But because of a lack of education or misunderstanding about the nature of substance use disorders, we think that restriction or not offering those things, making things harder, is somehow helping people. So hospital can be a traumatic place for people with substance use disorders, and in many ways it can be a harmful place as well.
So you've hinted at this already in your answer there, but I'm curious what ways specifically persons who have substance use disorder are maybe denied some indicated care or given a lower quality of care than they might otherwise get. And you've indicated maybe some education might be part of this, but what else might be behind that? Why does it happen?
Yeah, I think to start, the vast majority of people with substance use disorders, especially, people who use criminalized drugs and people who inject drugs, don't come to hospital at all. And that's because they've often had traumatic experiences in hospital. They feel like they've been dismissed or stigmatized. And so they know if they're going to go to hospital, they might be searched, they might be judged, they might be restricted access to substances that they need to stay well and keep out of withdrawal, might not have their pain treated. So many people, I learned this from talking to patients and community members, but there's also a great deal of research to support this now, stay away from hospital at all costs, treat themselves, treat their community members, and do whatever they can to avoid going. And then when it comes to the hospital environment itself, I mentioned that, you know, historically we haven't incorporated these practices into our education system, into our systems of care, our policies, our resources in the hospital environment. But that evidence and those interventions do exist. You know, it's our community-based standard of care. It's incorporated into our practice guidelines. Somebody who's using drugs in the community has access to these amazing community organizations I already mentioned. They can walk in and get medication treatment with methadone or buprenorphine the same day. They have access to sterile drug preparation and injecting equipment to prevent infections. They have access to take-home naloxone kits. And for many complicated reasons, we've just haven't offered that same standard of care in the hospital setting. So, you know, there's educational issues, there's policy issues, and in a big way, there's implementation problems.
Yeah, I'm really getting the sense from you that there's a kind of divide between how things are handled in community versus in acute care settings,
at least historically. I'm curious also about the role of stigma in all of this, in underpinning some of these systemic issues that you've identified. And why do you think that stigma persists in healthcare, of all places?
Yeah, I think this is a tricky question because it persists in many different ways and has a lot of different manifestations. You know, there's stigma against people who use drugs in our society broadly, and we as healthcare providers are members of society. So we bring with us those experiences that we have from growing up, from movies and culture, from our family, from our personal experiences with substance use, which may have been negative. As I mentioned, we go into these caring professions because we want to help. And if we haven't had education and training to counteract some of those misconceptions, then we're just left with what we've learned on our own. Some of that can represent as interpersonal stigma. So when healthcare providers are dismissive or try to be restrictive or punitive towards people with substance use disorders because they think that it might be helping. in some misguided way. But a lot of the manifestations of stigma are more structural. So I mentioned the fact that, you know, our hospital for the longest time didn't have anybody who had expertise or education in managing opioid withdrawal, didn't have anybody on staff with training to start people on methadone or buprenorphine, evidence-based treatment for addiction when they wanted it. Many hospitals have search and seizure policies where they're searching patients' bags or taking away harm reduction equipment, which is an evidence-based intervention when people do have access to it and harmful when it's removed. Our hospitals locally haven't had any policies related to substance use one way or another recently, so there was no standard set, clinical pathways, no resources dedicated to this, which it seems like for any other health condition would be unacceptable. But in that way, the stigma and marginalization of people who use drugs, people with substance use disorders, is kind of baked into the system.
The system that exists obviously is going to affect that any individual, the care that any individual can provide. But I am curious, as an individual, how do you make patients feel safe to be honest and transparent with you about their substance use?
I would say that we try our best and that patients have many legitimate, genuine reasons to not be honest and transparent with us. Everything from the war on drugs and criminalizing drug use to things like search and seizure policies that I mentioned. Many patients have had experiences of being cut off of prescription opioid medications when prescribers find out that they have an opioid use disorder, or dismissed from care when prescribers take that personally. And so our patients with substance use disorders have been told time and time again that they should lie to us if they want compassionate and quality health care. And so if somebody has a heart valve infection and needs to come to the hospital to get treatment, they've learned along the way that they should lie to us in order to get the life-saving medical care that they need. So we've tried to challenge that, especially with our new addiction medicine consult service, by providing expertise, expert care, being able to talk with patients with knowledge about what they might be using and how we might be able to help and reassure them that they're not going to be punished for using substances, and that we want to be able to support them with the tools we have available, including medications. And that's gone a long way. Building relationships and trust in a complicated and chaotic environment like the hospital is tough, and trying to undo decades of mutual mistrust and harm is tough. But building those relationships, speaking with some expertise and education about the topic and making sure patients know about all the potential options that are available is all helpful. And sometimes we still don't get there in terms of honesty and transparency, and I completely understand that, and we don't take that personally either. We just try to support people as best we can.
So sometimes patients might have a substance use disorder, and they might have also maybe other physical or mental health conditions, and there can be some challenging behaviors associated. So how do you manage these kinds of situations? How do you kind of hold people accountable for unacceptable behaviors, but also have a trauma-informed approach?
Yeah, I think that is a conversation we're often having in the hospital and trying to explore with our clinical colleagues about what behaviors in particular people are concerned about, how that might represent an unmet need, how we can change care plans and practices. And then on the other side of the spectrum, violence is unfortunately common in our hospitals these days, and healthcare providers need to be safe and feel safe in the hospital. And obviously violence, threats of violence are unacceptable. So a lot of the learning journey that we've been on at the hospital over the last 10 years or so is trying to figure out what behaviors are being triggered by the environment or might be modifiable, especially those directly related to substance use. So like Jenny in our case was clearly in a great deal of emotional distress, and she was able to explain to us that part of that, or a majority of that, was because she was in withdrawal, felt terrible, was in pain, didn't feel listened to, wasn't being taken seriously. And those are all things that we can address in the healthcare setting. We can manage her withdrawal, we can treat her pain, we can have a multidisciplinary meeting and get everybody on the same page about the care plan, make sure Jenny feels listened to, all that stuff. So those behaviors that might have been labeled as challenging and may have been escalating in the hospital can be managed, prevented. Jenny can be supported. The patients can be supported with a trauma-informed approach that recognizes there's lots of reasons why she would have this really intense emotional reaction to these circumstances. And so now that we have the addiction medicine consult service at the QE2 and we're able to kind of explore that, be as specific as possible, manage what we can manage. Of course, there's still violence that happens in the hospital, whether patients have substance use disorders or not. And so trying to have calm discussions and talk about expectations of what behavior is acceptable in the hospital, we would do with everyone, you know, even in my internal medicine job. But the substance use part of it is something that we can certainly manage with the expertise and resources. So it's unfortunate that this sort of expertise and education and clinical care that we're able to offer is not yet available across the province. It's not yet available in every hospital. And so my heart goes out to those patients who need to be in a hospital for serious medical problems, but still aren't yet having their withdrawal managed or their pain treated or feeling listened to. And so they're having, you know, a lot of distress associated with that.
It does seem to be a feature of our health system that in some areas of the health system, you can have one and only one health condition. And that sounds like what you're kind of describing.
Yeah, I think there's ways that our health system has tried to bring in expertise related to complexity and multimorbidity. We certainly learn a lot from the geriatrics model. My other job in general internal medicine really tries to embrace that generalism and pragmatism to meet patients' needs. So I think even though mainstream medicine hasn't incorporated these skills and tools of addiction medicine and harm reduction, that it completely aligns with patient-centered care and evidence-based medicine. And my hope is that within another generation, physicians and all healthcare providers will have a certain degree of comfort with this and just be able to incorporate this into the regular skill set for all clinical care. So it doesn't necessarily need to be specialized, but, you know, along the way, we're able to provide that support and education and help everybody get the skills that they may have missed in medical school or along the way.
That's great.
So I'm going to move away from the case study and just ask you a few forward-looking questions about addiction medicine more generally, particularly in acute care settings. So this is a difficult time for addiction medicine, it seems like, because there's a lot of conservative kind of political movement towards compulsory treatment of addictions and the closure of harm reduction facilities in the community. A lot's been written about these changes. I'm curious how some of these changes might affect care in hospitals and what we're seeing in the hospital.
Yeah, I think it's quite unfortunate, this political blowback against harm reduction and a public health approach to substance use that's happening in various parts of the country. The conversations that have been happening in Nova Scotia, I've felt much better about. I've been much more optimistic. I think we have a cultural identity here that aligns quite a bit with harm reduction. People really value compassion, taking care of one another. And so locally, we've still been able to grow our services, and we have really like leading harm reduction programs in the community that have been supported, you know, in by public health and the health system and government. So locally, we haven't been experiencing the same blowback, and we've been able to provide evidence-based patient-centered care and been able to continue public health interventions. The Nova Scotia Health has approved and will be implementing soon province-wide policies, setting a standard for substance use care and harm reduction in healthcare facilities across the province. And I think that's a huge step forward. So locally, I think things are headed in the right direction, and I hope they continue to do so. As I mentioned, I think this is increasingly just becoming a normal part of healthcare and a normal part of medicine, and maybe that's one way to keep the politics out as well.
Yeah, it sounds like you've been having some success here locally, and that's good to hear. I'm curious, just to finish this off here, what do you hope for the addiction medicine service? You've talked about already expanding it across the province. I've heard that some hospitals, for example, have things like safe injection sites within the hospitals. I'm curious about your thoughts, kind of looking ahead, what more could be done?
Yeah, that's a great question. As I mentioned, I think one of the fundamental problems related to substance use care in the hospital is that we have not yet implemented the evidence-based interventions that do exist. So we're making, I think, great strides and changing the standard of care at the QE2 hospital in Halifax, in part driven by the Addiction Medicine Consult Service and having that expertise and resource available in the hospital, being able to contribute to policy changes, policy implementation. That's not yet available at every hospital. So on some degree, just getting the basics right, making sure whether it's any community hospital or regional hospital in Nova Scotia, if you have a medical complication from substance use, you can start addiction treatment on demand and access harm reduction programs and community services that same day. We're not quite there yet. At the other end of the spectrum, I absolutely think that supervised injection sites, overdose prevention sites, should be integrated into the hospital setting. I'm leading a Research Nova Scotia-funded project to try to think about how that might be possible in Nova Scotia right now. So if folks are interested in getting involved, they could certainly get in touch with me. But as I mentioned, the whole motivation is that you should be able to access healthcare, life-saving medical care, whether or not you're using drugs. So these patients that we're caring for, if they were using drugs yesterday, they're using drugs this morning, they're not coming to the hospital seeking recovery, abstinence-based addiction treatment. Most of the time they're coming because they're unwell and in pain and septic and all that stuff. So we can't magically think that they're going to stop using drugs today just to be able to access life-saving medical care. Allowing people to stay in hospital, managing their withdrawal, offering them addiction treatment is all part of the puzzle, but we certainly need ways for people to stay safe and stay engaged in their hospital care, even if they're going to keep using drugs. And I absolutely think that should be in supervised injection sites, overdose prevention sites, rather than what currently happens, which is people locked alone in hospital bathrooms where there's nobody to respond with naloxone if they overdose, or using in the parking lot when nobody else is around, and situations that, again, increase the danger for hospitalized patients when they wouldn't be facing those same dangers if they were just out in the community where other resources are available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you think that acute care is giving a higher level of care, but it sounds like in this instance it has some gaps that we have in the community.
Yeah, that's right. And even more than gaps, the hospital environment increases harms for people with substance use disorders and people who use drugs, and creates risks because of the policy environment, the practice environment that people don't face when they're in the community. So, you know, if you're not in the hospital and you're just living your life, as I mentioned, you can walk in and access these services, but you can also be using with others. People can care for you and respond with naloxone if you overdose. You can use the same amount of drugs that you normally do from the same source or supplier that you normally do and not risk overdose in the hospital setting, where historically and at most hospitals still, we're expecting patients to suddenly stop using drugs, to lose their tolerance, disconnected from all their community supports. As I mentioned, using drugs alone in locked bathrooms. So I think we just need to shift our thinking and our approach to try to reduce those harms that come from the hospital environment as well.
That's great.
This has been a really interesting discussion. I'm so happy that I had the opportunity to chat with you. The title of this podcast is It's Complicated. And I'm wondering if, to finish this off, if you want to say anything about what makes addiction medicine in inpatient settings complicated.
Oh, sure. I guess my main message is that it doesn't need to be. I have funny conversations with colleagues all the time when they start to learn about these interventions and this practice in addiction medicine, that it's actually not that hard. We have a handful of medications. There's standard ways to initiate and dose them. The approach we take with patients involving harm reduction, trauma-informed care, is really patient-centered. And so the actual practice of addiction medicine in inpatient settings shouldn't be complicated, should be quite easy. The reason it remains complicated has to do with those historical drivers of stigma and marginalization we talked about, including the war on drugs and criminalizing people who use drugs and all of the stigma that flows from that. And also our policy environment. So as I mentioned, we hadn't had policies related to substance use at all, and the ones that did exist were restrictive and punitive and increased harm. So hopefully someday soon, the standard of care available in the hospital related to substance use equals that available in the community, and the rest will be easy peasy. And a final reason why it's complicated does have to do with the conditions in the community. So we can have somebody in with us in hospital for 6 weeks, as you mentioned, and they can set their goals and we can start addiction treatment and they can make all sorts of progress. And unfortunately, in our province, many of these patients are being discharged to homelessness, and lack of housing in our community, having to live on the street, completely sabotages any gains we can make, any progress people can make in their recovery and addiction treatment goals. So I think, you know, all those services should be available in the community. We need much more of them implemented in acute care. And unfortunately, people need a place to live and be safe to make these kinds of life changes with their addiction treatment as well.
Thanks for that.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brothers, for sharing an insight into your work and your reflections here today. We really appreciate your time. We are also grateful to production support from Lisbeth Witthoff-Nielsen and Krista Mlesko-Skerry and the team at DAO-Med IT. Thanks to Ben Capps for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. Thank you.